Hello, my name is Colleen Dietz.
And I'm Miranda Crandall. We are the Angels on Fire.
And this is Mormon Happy Hour. We are two post-Mormon gals bringing you the hottest topics in Mormonism. We will keep you current, keep you entertained, and keep you tuned in. Welcome to episode 19 of the Mormon Happy Hour. We have a lot to talk about today. First up, we have Julian Jesse again on the show with us today to talk about the celebration, the 40th anniversary celebration that the LDS Church is hosting on the lifting of the priesthood ban. So we're going to kind of discuss what it means to throw a celebration and whether this is an appropriate use of the term.
Right. And Julian's well-versed in the history of the ban, so we get to discuss that with him.
Yeah. So we're excited to do that.
We also have an amazing teaser clip for you from a local whiskey expert who has her own podcast called Neatly on the Rocks.
Yeah. And then last up, we gave you a little teaser last week in our episode for Mormon sex myths. So we're really excited to hit that one hard this week. And then we're going to see how long we can stretch it out because it's so much material. We could talk to you for hours today.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about on that topic. So
we're going to introduce it and then we'll stretch it out. So see how long our endurance is, right? And that's about where we're going to get started.
All right, let's do it.
So right now the church is planning a celebration for lifting the ban on black people in the priesthood. Colleen, what can you tell us about this celebration?
Well, it's a 40-year anniversary of the lift of the ban. I happened to catch something on social media that, do you have it in front of you? You want to read it real quick? Because I think it's a really good introduction to the topic.
Sure, yeah. So on social media, we found this very interesting comparison. Some anniversaries are best left alone by an institution, the kind that draw attention to things that you want a pat on the back for, but all they really do is draw attention to how horrible you have been. So for example, a guy wouldn't announce a big celebration to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the day he stopped beating his wife. If the wife wants to have a party to celebrate her liberation from your idiocy, cool. But you ought to just let the whole thing glide by. Especially if you say something like, I'm sure glad that 40 years ago, the long-awaited day came when God told me I could stop beating my wife. Oh, but regarding the years that I did beat her, there will be no plausible explanation and certainly no apology forthcoming. God being mysterious and whatnot.
That just really, really, really speaks to me because I feel like that encompasses the entire issue, that the ban was from God. They've never backed down from that, and that they're commemorating this lift, you know, as if it's revelation from God that they can stop being awful people, and they still will not issue any sort of apology, which if all things considered, I feel like if they're going to recognize this 40-year anniversary in any way, it should be with transparency, honesty, and an apology. And that's just me talking, but we have Julian here, so yeah. I would love to hear kind of some feedback from you on, I don't know, what your thoughts are on the celebration of the lift of the ban.
Well, let me just qualify my overall statement by saying that I agree with most of what you said. It is egregious that they're calling it a celebration. Now, let me just slightly, and I know it sounds like we're pulling hairs, Miranda, but let me just slightly disagree with a little bit of what you said. Sure. And just give a little bit more of what I think about the statement that you read. I'm completely okay with celebrating an anniversary if it includes progression. For example, when you are addicted to drugs or alcohol and you say, I'm celebrating 30 years of sobriety, that is perfectly acceptable because you have acknowledged it, you've acknowledged the wrongdoing, and you have moved forward. And an apology even is not enough. What needs to take place is after you have this well-established religious organization on the earth, there has not been a lot, there's not been one until recently, if you want to call a person of color, Asian, you know, there has, and Brazilian, there has not been one black apostle, That is huge. There's been very few Black general authorities. We have one, Joseph Tatati was called in 2008, coincidentally, right after President Obama was elected, which I thought that that was perfect timing. That he got called into the first quorum, and that had been the first Black general authority in the first quorum since the priesthood ban. And I don't think that that was a coincidence in 2009, excuse me, when he was called right after President Obama got elected. Most people think that that may have been coincidental. I don't. I think that that was well calculated in a shrewd move by the church. Also, you have to ask yourself, why 40 years? Why not 25? Why not 20? Why 40? You have to ask these questions because 40 is a number that doesn't make sense. Usually it's 50, 25, maybe 30. Why 40? And why are they calling it a celebration? Well, we can extrapolate and take from that and speculate, I mean, and to suggest that maybe that they're trying to push past it and maybe trying to placate existing members because the church is going down in activity and they do need to address it. And it was never, like Colleen, I agree with you, it was never properly addressed. And until it's properly addressed, they can't go forward. But let me just add one more thing. I think it's equally egregious that women are not allowed to have the priesthood in this organization. We're so used to this condition. But Joseph Smith ordained Black people in the priesthood. This is well documented. And he didn't ordain 10 or 20. He ordained several, as he did women. So when you know these things about church history and you continue to celebrate something, it doesn't hold water, is what I'm trying to say.
So with this situation, you have Black members of the church who are coordinating and planning and, you know, spreading this message of this celebration. Do you find that this celebration is a good thing for those members?
If they feel it's a good thing, if this helps them heal, then yeah, I would say it's a good thing for them. It is not a good thing for me and my family. I don't want to split this into a Black or white issue. I don't think this is good for any church member. I think anytime an organization hides the truth from its members, it's bad, whether you're Black or white. So I just want to say that. I don't think this is good for white members. I don't think segregation is good for white people, okay, as well as Black people. And studies have shown that also. But first of all, it's not a celebration. I don't know why they call it that. But if they want to help, if they want to use this as a stepping stone, if they want to stay in an organization that has been dishonest with them and the rest of its members, then have at it, okay? It's not for me. I've done a ton of research and look, and I know Darius. I've met him on several, I've met him about 20 years ago.
Wow.
So we've had several conversations over the years, not for at least 10 years. But he and I have disagreed on a number of different issues.
So you mentioned knowing Darius Gray. The Salt Lake Tribune mentions in their article that Darius Gray, who is a founder of Genesis, a support group for Black Mormons, for those of you who don't know, he says that racially insensitive comments and attitudes concerning persons of color have not all gone away yet. Julian, do you think that these attitudes will ever go away, or are they too ingrained in the LDS doctrine and mindset?
So your question, basically, I feel like are two different questions. One, will things get better in the church? Well, church history has shown us that society has really influenced the church more than the church has influenced society. For example, the church had the so-called revelation on Blacks can now have the priesthood in 1978. But that was 10 years after the civil rights movement essentially, kind of unofficially ended, after the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. That was more than 10 years after interracial marriage was legal in the United States. So those things had to happen first in order for the church to change its policy. Let's not make any mistake about that. Women's rights had to happen before women could enter the temple solo. Those things have to happen. So I'm going to say that's more of a societal issue. So I'm going to say yes, that things will change. Because if you would have asked any of my family members in the 1980s or 90s, if they're ever going to be a Black president, I can promise you half of them would have said no. I see some progression. I don't want to ignore that. But I do think things will get better. I have to believe that, because otherwise, what's the point of speaking out against on these issues?
Right. So the church is a slow mirror of society, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is.
Okay. Yeah, I completely agree.
So I just want to do a recap of, for any of our listeners out there who may not know what these issues are. Julian, can you give us a quick history rundown of the blacks and priesthood and what we're talking about here?
Okay, well, the brief history is, I'm from Illinois, so I'm going to run down and just hit some highlights. Joseph Smith had a revelation, which nobody can actually find, on polygamy in the early 1930s. He started practicing it somewhere between the 1830s and early 1940s. When that happened, the saints were driven west because there were some people opposed to polygamy, and Joseph Smith was killed. Prior to that, Joseph Smith issued the priesthood to most notably a man by the name of Elijah Abel. Him and several other people that I can't recall their names right now were given the priesthood. This is at least 100 different black people.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Now, right, according to my records. Now, let me paraphrase. Elijah Abel was sent on a mission, and he was accused of a crime. When some of the elders heard about it, particularly Orson Pratt, I believe, they had issued somewhat of a policy that says, okay, you can't go out on a mission anymore, you can't proselytize anymore, and that is the earliest of my particular records that I can find when the priesthood began, okay? Then Brigham Young issued a statement, a doctrinal issue. And by the way, some church members will say it's doctrinal versus policy. Well, that's problematic as well, but that's a whole nother can of worms.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. Brigham Young used the existing scriptures to say, because black people, skin is a curse and they come from the seed of Cain, that they mm-hmm. can no longer have the priesthood. That was not Joseph Smith's position as far as I can tell.
Right. That's not how Joseph intended it, but that's how Brigham Young interpreted it.
Right.
Correct.
Right. And so when the saints were essentially, they left the country and they entered the country of Mexico, which is now Utah, uh-huh. they continued that ban up until the 1920s, when it was brought up by an apostle, a future apostle named Hugh B. Brown, which advocated to end that ban, and other people in the quorum and other apostles said no. David O. McKay was asked to end that ban. He said no, up until the 1970s, when the ban was eventually lifted. And by the way, there was, once again, I'm giving a very quick rundown, there was pressure on the church to end that ban.
Right.
Some schools mm-hmm. like Stanford University wouldn't, for example, would not play BYU because of this ban.
Wow.
Back in what year? Early, right?
This is in the late 1960s. Yeah, Stanford University boycotted playing BYU because of this ban.
Wow.
And also, I have to mention this, and this is really highly important. And once again, I don't have the exact year, but the Supreme Court, there's some churches in the South that wanted to practice segregation. And the Supreme Court said, yes, you can practice segregation under one condition. That condition being that you pay taxes. So
that's good.
Yes. So that was in 1972, 71. Once again, I'm just giving a very quick rundown.
Right.
The church did excommunicate people who advocated for black people to have the priesthood. Right. So that's also true. When the priesthood so-called revelation was given on the quote unquote policy, it ended. So that's my very quick rundown.
Great.
Thank you.
So when I first left the church, I first discovered all these issues. A member from my branch told me that he personally knew the first black man to receive the priesthood. And if that man was okay with the ban, and that if it didn't bother him, that it shouldn't bother me either. What is your opinion on that statement, Julian?
That is absolutely, utterly ridiculous.
Yes.
That is, and I have some people in my family, when desegregation began in the 1950s, there were members of my family who did not want to participate in it. When women wanted to vote, there were women strongly against it. So that's just utterly preposterous. There are Native Americans in favor of racist logos that the Cleveland Indians have. There are people who are okay with the name, the Washington Redskins. you're always going to find people within a marginalized group who claim to be okay with it. Speaking with one person from one person's anecdotal point of view is doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do.
Right. I totally agree. And that's essentially what I told him was, I said, well, do I have to be Jewish to hate what happened during the Holocaust? No, I don't. I don't have to be a part of these groups to see the atrocities that happened to an entire minority.
Well, let me say this. I'm going to butcher a quote by Benjamin Franklin, and it goes something like this. We will not see change. Change will not happen until the people who are unaffected are as outraged as the people who are affected. Okay?
Amen.
Yes, beautiful.
We cannot idly sit by when women are marginalized in the country and when Black people are marginalized and Hispanics are classified as rapists and criminals. Yeah. We don't have to be part of that group to speak out for them or on behalf of them. It doesn't work that way. It shouldn't work that way, especially if you are part of a minority class. You don't have to be a part of that group to to speak out. And then throughout history, we've had to reach the masses, quite frankly, to really affect change. You know, particularly, and I'm speaking in America. You know, I'm not speaking outside of the country. I'm speaking about change in America for anybody who understands history, how it works, and how change is instituted in this country.
Absolutely.
So his statement's preposterous.
Yeah.
So I will say names, and I will put them on the record. I'm going to put people on the record like Alex Boyer, James the Mormon, and Darius Gray. I'm going to include in this group. I'll even say Gladys Knight, who are well-known Black LDS members of the church. And I feel like the church uses them as a shield to hide the discrimination of what's really going on in the church. I was a member of the church for 25 years. Okay, I'm no longer a member. I'm no longer active. My wife and I no longer plan on attending regularly, and I don't participate in church activities. But it's quite interesting how you see these members, these Black LDS members, are constantly paraded out there to make it seem like that the rest of the church is not racist or does not have a race problem, when only up until 2018, they finally have one minority apostle in almost 200 years. The church has been around for 175 years. But one at the top doesn't justify years of discrimination within the church.
Yeah.
And a few people who are paraded out there doesn't justify a lot of the discrimination that's taken place within the church. So that
doesn't atone for the sins of the past. So I didn't want to be another white voice throwing out there talking about an issue that I don't have personal experience with. I just didn't want to do that. But then, you know, the tithing and the dowry thing in Africa happened, and I'm like, okay, it's too much.
You can't avoid
and so it needs to be addressed, and I want to provide that platform. And so in all of my ex-Mormon activism, all of these groups on Facebook, ex-Mormon Reddit, I feel like I couldn't think of any people of color that are outspoken and active in the ex-Mormon community. I want to come out and say, like, maybe I am not seeing it. Maybe that there's still something that I haven't adjusted my own view to. Maybe I'm not seeing it. Or maybe it doesn't exist in the community. And so my question was, why is this so difficult for me to find someone of this community to speak? And why do I not know their face and know their name and know their voice? Is it that there's residual racism that carries over even after we've left the church? Have they left these spaces and gone back to communities that are more accepting of them? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. And that's a great question. And my short answer is my wife and I feel the same way. We have invested years, tithing dollars, family members have been lost because we're members of this organization. And for me, I just wanted to wash myself clean. I have personally known three apostles. I've worked for the church. I served a mission. I feel like my time is done. So I kind of don't want to revisit. And you want to talk about an abusive relationship. I don't want to keep talking about it. There's a part of me that doesn't want to keep talking about it. And then there's a part of me that says, I need to speak up about it because there are people who need to hear my voice. So I struggle with those two things. So I struggle with it from a personal standpoint, and I struggle with it from a, and this is just my stuff that I need to deal with when I look in the mirror. There's a part of me that just says, okay, I'm done with this. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And then there's things like what Nelson said that pull me back in to say, no, that's just complete bullshit. You cannot think this way. So I struggle with it myself. So I know two other Black members who have left the church. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to be seen. They go about their merry way. They don't discuss it. It was never really a part of their lives to begin with, because the church is, it's cultural. The culture has influenced the religion much more so than religion has influenced the culture. It is cyclical, but some people don't. I never fit into the culture. I fit into the religion, but not the cultural aspects. So there's a part of me that just wants to leave and live my life and travel and spend time with my kids. And I've got my own stuff to deal with. So I feel like a lot of church members have left because of that. And you touched on it. They do go back to what's comfortable to them. And I'm speaking on, I can't speak for every Black person that leaves the church, but maybe I can just speak for myself. I do go back to what I'm comfortable with and living my life and trying to make up for those years that I feel like I lost. Now, I have to add this. I met my wonderful, lovely wife because I was a member of the church. Outside of that, you know, I've still got some wonderful friends, obviously people like Miranda, who I've kept in contact with. But outside of that, there's a part of me that has deep regret and there's a lot of pain that's associated with even mentioning the church.
I honor that. I really do.
Julian, is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I just want to say another thing to Colleen's point, and I could go on this topic forever, that I'm a firm believer that you do not have to be, and I'm not sure if this is what you were saying, and I really respect Colleen's position about when she said she wanted to speak to someone who had a more valid experience. I mean, I respect that. But I want to say that when I saw, and I'm going to bring this up because I think it's relevant, I saw something happen about a year ago that I had never seen before in American history, and that was Charlottesville. And that was a turning point for me because I saw white people. There were some people of color, but I saw white people standing up against the alt-right and members of the Klan and members of the neo-Nazis. That to me is progression, because that had never happened before in American history on that scale. We've seen Black people stand up, but we hadn't seen that many white people stand up. And I think that's a good thing. And look, if your motives are pure, it doesn't matter what color your skin is. You are allowed, as a white person, to speak up for people of color. Don't ever feel like you're not allowed. You are allowed. If you're a man, you're allowed to speak up for women's rights. If you're heterosexual, you're allowed to speak up for LGBT people. That you're allowed to do that. And I think that you should do it. As long as you speak to those people of that community, then it's perfectly acceptable. If your heart is pure and you want to see change for the better, I don't want to get into this attitude of you have to be Black to speak up for Black lives, or you have to be a woman to speak up for women's issues. That is how they divide us. And now more than ever, we need to be speaking up for one another and be sensitive to each other's needs. Really quick, a personal note, my wife and I are absolutely disgusted at the church's stance against the LGBTQ community. We think it's utterly ridiculous. I'm as heterosexual as they come, but it doesn't matter. This is a human issue. This is not a Black or white issue. This exactly. We are fighting for equality. We're not fighting for just our own self-interest.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Colleen, is there any final thoughts that you have?
Just that I'm really grateful and honored that you took the time to dive into something that's traumatic and difficult, and that I don't think that, you know, Miranda and I could even begin to understand. So I'm really grateful that you took the time to say it from your own words and to share with us something so that we can learn more from you. So thank you so much for taking that time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I just want to say with a little quick final thought, if there's anyone out there, specifically a person of color, who has a story that they need to tell, if there is something that they need to get out there, then I am more than happy to use our platform to spread this message and to give those people a voice.
Thank you, Miranda.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on our show and sharing your knowledge and opinions about these issues with us.
Thank you for calling me. Thank you so much to meet you, Jillian. You too. All right.
So for today's life pro tip, we are talking about tattoos. If you guys watch our videos, then you can see that I have tattoos. I like tattoos. It is a way to express oneself. So, yeah, now I get to express myself permanently on my skin. My advice, the actual life pro tip that I want to say is don't rush. Take your time. Find an expensive artist. The more expensive it is, the nicer it will be. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, basically with almost anything you buy, that's how it goes.
Well, and this is an art form and an actual skill.
Right, right.
Both.
As much as I would love to go in on Friday the 13th and get a $20 flash tattoo because it sounds so much fun, I never do it because the quality is going to be bad. It's going to be slapped on there. You know, I haven't well thought it through. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's forever, unlike families.
Unlike Mormon family doctrine. Right. Families are forever.
So, you know, my life pro tip is to just wait, you know, have an idea in your head for a year. My first one over here is a female boxer tattoo. I'm into American traditional tattoos. Anyways, so I had this idea for about a year before I pulled the trigger on it. Mm-hmm. And I did my research. I found a local artist that was fantastic. And then about 6 months later, I got my second one. And you know what? They turned out great. And it doesn't really matter to me. It doesn't really matter what the tattoo is. It could be anything. As long as it's done well, then it's going to look great. And nobody really cares that it's something that they're not interested in. You know, I could do, you know, something, the cheesiest tattoo you can think of, dolphins and seashells. I don't know if you like that. You know, that's fine. But, you know, the cheesiest, flowers, the weirdest thing you could think of, if you get an amazing professional artist to do your tattoo, then it's going to look awesome. That's what you need. So that's what you got to focus on, finding the artist and finding, and not skimping on the money. You got to pay the price. Speaking of paying the price, pain. There's different thoughts about, you can get numbing creams and sprays and whatnot. Some people think that you should go through the pain to earn the tattoo.
Like childbirth?
You know, yeah, what? I don't know. I think that's a little much. I do think that a first tattoo should be just raw. Like, you shouldn't necessarily numb the pain with your first tattoo. But that's more for a point of reference about, I don't know how much pain you can take. Usually your first tattoo is not going to be something in a place that's extremely painful. Or if it is, then your tattoo artist might say something.
My husband has tattoos. He didn't grow up Mormon, but I don't know. Like, I don't have anything like morally against tattoos. That's not my hesitation. My hesitation is like, I just feel like I'm so indecisive and I never like anything long-term and I'm always wanting change in my life. And I can't think of anything that I have liked long enough to get permanently on my body. I'm sure there's a lot of psychological things that you could pull out of this, but I don't want to get something. And I just have this fear that I'm going to hate it in a year and then I can't do anything
about it. That's a valid fear and totally fine. And if you don't want to get tattoos, that's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, So don't rush. I mean, I would rather somebody not have a tattoo than rush into it and then regret it.
Like, my husband has tattoos, and now I'm an ex-Mormon, and I'm like, I don't want to just run out and get a tattoo because that's the thing to do. Like, I want to do it for me, and I just don't feel it yet.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I haven't done
it. Good for you. That's, you know, that's good.
It's a lot of fear talking, but whatever. Job break!
I want to shoot the strawberry whiskey, my favorite.
All right, you take, do you want
yeah, hold on.
The heavy one, and I'll take the light one? Do you want to take the light one? I'll take the heavy one.
I can do the heavy one.
I don't care.
Cheers.
Cheers. Mm. Whew. Oh. Whew. Ah. Mm. Wow. That was different after coffee.
I love it. Love it.
All right. You ready to dive into these Mormon sex myths? So, what even brought up this idea?
We were doing a live pro tip on another episode, and we wanted to do a non-alcoholic
one.
And so we brought up sex and those issues.
That's right.
And because of that, you put out there all over social media about people's experiences with sex and the myths that they heard. And there was an overwhelming response. Tons of response.
So I put it in probably like a half dozen ex-Mormon and progressive Mormon groups that I'm in on Facebook. And most of them had well over 100 responses. And so we're really excited to dive in. A lot of them are really super hilarious and funny and awkward. And then there is also the flip side of the coin that is very abusive and damaging
and depressing
and really depressing. Kind of the results of a highly orthodox, conservative, sex-shaming, abstinence-only culture, and kind of the results of what that can do to a person's sexual identity.
Yeah.
Basically, Cliff Notes, it really fucks it up.
Yeah.
So that's the depressing flip coin. So we're going to kind of try and take all of them, keep them lighthearted, but also you know, pay respect to the damage that it does do. All right. So first up, a theme that kept coming up was that we as Mormons have a complete and total lack of sex education as children growing up, growing into our sexual development and identity. No education whatsoever. One myth that kept coming up was that as Mormons, we were taught that our first time is going to be amazing.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was taught that. Oh my God. And that was, I mean, as you said, a hugely recurring theme.
Yeah.
And, you know, no offense.
To the first time.
But, you know, it was beautiful, but not in the ways that I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
So.
Totally. And also that premarital sex is all about lust, and then after you're married, it's all about love. And that's
it's all about babies too.
Well, yeah.
But
if you have sex drives and urges and things like that before you're married, then that's all Satan and that's the devil and that's lustful. But as soon as you're married, like that's of God, and that's all about, you know, eternal families,
so,
and it just
turning
like
that
overnight.
Switch was so hard, and like I had this conversation with my husband when we were first married, like this is very hard, you know,
to turn the
turning
switch.
That switch immediately from this is evil and bad and dirty to, you know,
you're just
Jesus' stamp of approval, which was, you know, if you think about it, it's kind of creepy that it's like,
so
God, this
creepy.
Is sacred and God and godly and holy. And you're like, it's something,
weird.
You know,
what?
It's weird to think of that intimacy as like sacred and holy.
Because you're taught your whole upbringing that you're supposed to suppress those feelings. Those feelings are of the devil.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden when you have the same exact feelings, you're supposed to somehow change all of this repetitive pattern of thinking to something different.
Yeah.
It's not that easy. Kind of along those same lines, another theme, oh my gosh, this is so gross. So speaking of lust versus love, everything that Wendy Watson Nelson ever talked about before she was ever married, awful. So I'll have to put her talk in the show notes. She gives this talk about intimacy. And this was before she was even, this was when she was just Wendy Watson. So she got married very late in life as a virgin. So she was like, I want to say in her 50s maybe when she married wow. Nelson. And so she's giving this talk on, and I think she technically has a degree in, I want to say family counseling. I have to look it up. But she has some sort of educational background in sex. And so her experience is education-wise from a very Mormon perspective. You know, she went to BYU, so all of her education is very, you know, whatever. And so then she gives this talk on what sex should be like to a bunch of married couples. And it's so bad. But she talks about including the Holy Ghost, and you should open and close the act with prayer.
Are you kidding me?
And you need to invite the Holy Spirit into your bedroom, and it needs to be pure. Like, the quotes are terrible.
That's creepy.
Fucking creepy, dude.
Like, and she wouldn't know that because she was a virgin.
Yeah.
But you do not, like, having sex and making it, like, holy and sacred like that is not enjoyable. Like, you can't.
It's just awkward.
You don't want to be intimate like that.
What a way to kill the
Especially mood. Because, like, you're praying, when you, kids pray. You go to church and you go to primary and teach them about prayer, and then you're like, oh, yeah. Like, it's just too.
Mm-mm. So, my comment, because this came up on our thread, and I'm like, someone said, well, would it be more awkward to do the opening prayer or the closing prayer? I was like, well, I'll volunteer for the closing prayer as long as it's me shouting, oh, God, and then that's it. If that's the closing prayer, we're good. I'll volunteer for that one. Your face is red.
That's so funny. I'm blushing. Miranda is blushing.
Your face is so red. You look like the strawberry whiskey all over your face.
Oh, man.
That's
so funny.
Anyway.
I was thinking, hopefully it's that and not, you know, dear God, let it be better next time.
Rough. Oh, should we talk about the TK smoothie? Since you didn't know that one?
Sure. Let's talk about the TK smoothie.
TK smoothie. So any of you who don't know if you haven't ever heard of the TK smoothie, Mormon doctrine is that only the highest level of heaven is broken into three levels, three subcategories of how wonderful you are, according to God. So only Mormons really, only devout, Orthodox, by the book, you followed all the rules your whole life and you were church broke and you were amazing. Those are really the only people that are going to make it to the celestial kingdom.
Right.
You are sealed in the temple, open to polygamy in heaven, have a billion kids. What was the minimum? Like three wives?
I don't know.
There was a magic number of
wives.
See,
I didn't know any of this until I found out and left the church immediately.
Anyway. Celestial kingdom. So in order to make it to the celestial kingdom, well, one of the privileges of making it to the celestial kingdom is that there is polygamy in the celestial kingdom. So men will have their pick of all of the abundance of women who make it to heaven. And they can be, you know, polygamously sealed to multiple women in heaven. And then once you get to the celestial kingdom and you have multiple wives, that's when you go about creating your own world. And so you procreate your own progenies. Yeah, your own spirit heaven world, your own spirit world. And so, you know, better get busy. And so it's only the celestial kingdom where procreation, sex, is permitted, where it's allowed, where it happens. Because down, like, in no other kingdom are you with your spouse, technically. Only in the celestial kingdom can you be guaranteed to be with your family.
Sealed, yeah. Guaranteed that you'll be sealed and with your family.
Yeah. So there's the celestial kingdom. That's the top. That's where you get procreative privileges. And then there's the telestial kingdom and the terrestrial kingdom. Terrestrial kingdom. Let's back
it up.
Celestial,
telestial.
Telestial. Terrestrial. And so terrestrial is all of the people who were amazing, wonderful, good people, but didn't get all of the sealings and the covenants and things like that that they had. Maybe they weren't even baptized. Maybe they never heard of the church. That's all those people. So all of your amazing, wonderful neighbors and friends that aren't Mormon, they're going to be in the terrestrial kingdom. So since the celestial kingdom is the only kingdom where you can have procreative privileges, in the telestial kingdom and the terrestrial kingdom, you don't have genitals. So
You don't have genitals?
Yeah. Well, okay. If you had genitals, then you could reproduce, Miranda. So they don't have
maybe
genitals.
They have genitals. They just can't do
it. I'll have to see if there's a reference specifically that says that they don't have genitals. But but that's been the joke. And so it was lovingly called a TK smoothie. So Telestial Kingdom or Terrestrial Kingdom smoothie. So you're smooth like Barbie. So think Barbie or Ken doll, and that's what you're going to look like in the Terrestrial and Telestial Kingdom. Hence the TK smoothie.
Here's a clip of our upcoming episode with Christina Rossetti, where we talk about Fireball Saints.
The temple that was in Kirtland was not used in the same way that LDS temples are used today. So the foot washing would have made sense, given that the endowment looked like Pentecost and it looked like the Last Supper, and that's kind of what the endowment was like.
Okay.
And it looked like the Book of Acts. It didn't look like, there's nothing like real Masonic about it. There was no Adam and Eve narrative. It was pre-Novo. So very explicit says, washed with whiskey and perfumed with cinnamon. So at the time...
And the teaser for a new bonus material video about whiskey with Paige from Neatly on the Rocks.
So this particular scotch is aged in three different types of casks. So it's kind of a little bit of like cherry and a lot of wood flavor, but it's not smoky. So I always recommend when you're drinking anything for the first time, you drink it in a Glencairn glass, whether it's scotch or rye or bourbon, whatever you're drinking. And the reason for it is the really alcoholic smelling vapor.
I feel like I'm at a loss for words. This is a whole new experience. It's fantastic.
That's kind of how I felt the first time I had a scotch that I really liked. I was like, wow, my mind has just...
All right, that's all we have for today. Be sure to check out the Mormon Happy Hour podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Patreon. Thanks for listening to the Mormon Happy Hour. Cheers!
Listen.
Fucking strong. In my mouth. She was old.
Very explicit says, urination.